From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, February 10, 2009. Geithner outlines the $1 trillion Treasury plan, while Fed Chair Bernanke defends the $2 trillion financial market investment. We'll go to Georgia, where activists are pushing for a people's bailout. And we'll hear why former SEIU healthcare workers are filing at the National Labor Relations Board. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Some 5 million Israelis were eligible to vote in elections today that will decide the makeup of Israel's parliament. Nearly 60% of them made it to the polls, and preliminary official results are due early tomorrow. Ghassan Banoura is with the International Middle East Media Center.
Israeli elections are based on proportional representation, and voters do not choose individuals, but rather cast their ballots for a party list. The latest polls show the leader of the right-wing Likud party, Benjamin Netanyahu, is likely to win the prime minister's race. But the margin between Netanyahu and rival Tzipi Livni of the center-right Kadima party has shrunk considerably. The similarities between the two candidates and their relative popularity reveal an increasingly conservative electorate. Sergio Yanni, an Israeli political analyst, explains.
The center was re-established in Israel, and all the political parties hold a similar political line. Since 5-6 years, we have only a traditional right, a conservative right in Israel.
So far, reports suggest the elections process is going smoothly. However, there were several violations reported in polling stations in Jerusalem. And in the Arab-Israeli town of Umm al-Fahim, clashes broke out between Israeli police and the residents who were trying to block the arrival of election monitor Baruch Marzel, a far-right Israeli politician and settler. For FSRN and IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Banoura.
There's still no word on Philip Rizk, the blogger, filmmaker, and activist who was detained by Egyptian officials after a peaceful pro-Palestinian march in Cairo last Friday. Rizk is being held at an undisclosed location. His family's home in Cairo was searched in the early hours of Monday morning, and his father was threatened with arrest. Protests calling for his release were held in London and Cairo today. Other actions are scheduled across the U.S. this week. And according to the Arabic Network for Human Rights Information, another blogger was also detained in Egypt last Friday. Dia Eden Gad is the author of the blog An Angry Voice. Witnesses say he was beaten by authorities in the street in front of his home before being taken by the police. Gad's whereabouts are also unknown. Homeowners facing foreclosure in Colorado will be able to keep their homes after Countrywide Financial, which merged with Bank of America, settled a lawsuit yesterday over predatory home loan practices. Blake Wesley has the story.
Countrywide has agreed to pay over $6 million to homeowners who claim they were deceived into high-risk, high-cost loans. The suit alleges lenders were pushing unsecured loans with low introductory rates that skyrocketed after 5 to 10 years. Attorney General John Souther says borrowers were victimized by the company's home loan practices. Countrywide is being ordered to rework the loans for nearly 7,000 homeowners and waive possible late fees in the future. Earlier this month, the company also settled an $8 million lawsuit for pushing unaffordable home loans in West Virginia. Since Countrywide was founded in 1969, they have claimed their mission is to break down the financial barriers to owning a home. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Blake Wesley.
Members of the Mexican Army and state police have taken over the municipal police force of the resort town of Cancun. Shannon Young has more.
An estimated 60 soldiers surrounded Cancun's municipal police headquarters in a pre-dawn operation on Monday, taking a roll call of those present and later appearing for shift change. The soldiers also confiscated and cataloged police firearms. Cancun's interim chief of police was taken into custody and put on a plane to Mexico City to appear before federal organized crime investigators. The military takeover of the police force came 1 week after the group assassination of 3 individuals, including a retired general who had been tapped to lead an anti-narcotics unit of the Cancun police force. The governor of Quintana Roo has put the state police chief in charge of a cleanup operation to purge the Cancun police ranks of officers suspected of ties to organized crime, a level of corruption the governor himself called, quote, extreme. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
The subject of climate change is at the center of a political storm in Northern Ireland. Don Duncan is in Dublin.
Sammy Wilson, the Minister of the Environment in the province's Legislative Assembly, has blocked a UK government advertising campaign on climate change, calling it an insidious propaganda campaign. Environmental groups have called for his sacking and were joined in criticism by other political parties, including the Green Party, which put forward a motion today calling for the minister's removal from office, saying he's, quote, making a laughingstock of Northern Ireland. Wilson is a member of the Democratic Unionist Party, which entered into the historic power-sharing agreement with the Nationalist Party Sinn Féin in 2006. The environment is one of 10 government departments handed over to Belfast when power was devolved from Westminster in 1998. Wilson's blocking of this campaign is an assertion of local governmental power and also of his deep scepticism of the arguments behind climate change, which he has called on previous occasions a hysterical pseudo-religion. In Dublin, this is Dawn Duncan for FSRN.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke testified in Congress today in an attempt to explain financial market investments worth up to $2 trillion. This is money spent in addition to the $700 billion bailout Congress passed and the $1 trillion plan Treasury Secretary Geithner introduced today. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke confided that the Federal Reserve is inserting $2 trillion into the financial markets through loans. Bernanke told Chair of the Financial Services Committee Barney Frank that only $100 billion, or 5%, is spent on risky lending to companies such as Bear Stearns and AIG.
The 95%, the bulk of our lending, those programs are extremely safe. They are over-collateralized. I could go through each one. I did in my remarks and explain why each one of them is safe, mostly very short-term, and very constructive.
And that would be about $1.9
trillion? That would be at $1.9 trillion, that's correct.
The Fed is able to intervene in the markets due to a little-known provision signed into law during the Great Depression in 1932. It allows the Fed to greatly expand its power in, quote, unusual and exigent circumstances. The Federal Reserve is able to do more than Treasury, which is limited by the amount taxpayers give it. The Federal Reserve can expand its portfolio even more by printing money and cashing in on investments to an unlimited amount of $5, $10, or even $12 trillion. On Capitol Hill Tuesday, Republican Jeb Hensarling of Texas questioned the Fed's unprecedented level of autonomy in this expanded role.
As I read the law, I don't see what requires you to necessarily wind it down. Can you cite me the provision?
Yes, sir. The law requires that we find that conditions be unusual and exigent. So when financial markets begin to look more normal, we would no longer have the authority.
But it's your determination.
That's correct.
Some economists and lawmakers have criticized these secretive actions of the Federal Reserve. Bloomberg News has filed suit seeking information. Under the Federal Reserve's expanded power, decisions are made behind closed doors, and the Congress has little oversight capability. Ranking Republican of the Financial Services Committee, Spencer Backus, questioned Bernanke on the Fed's level of voluntary openness.
The assets and the prices paid are valuations, are those disclosed?
The categories of securities and loans are disclosed, and the valuation is
done. By categories, I mean as to...
We don't think that those companies didn't ask to be in that portfolio, and we don't want to cast aspersions on them because they happen to be captured in that operation. But if your staff would like more detailed information, we can arrange to have that information provided.
Bernanke says the Federal Reserve is revamping their procedures to be more transparent.
Federal Reserve staff are developing a new website that will bring together in a systematic and comprehensive way the full range of information that the Federal Reserve already makes available, supplemented by new explanations, discussions, and analyses.
Robert Auerbach, professor at University of Texas and author of Deception and Abuse at the Fed, says transparency needs to be as unprecedented as its power.
It's very important that we find out who gets what. Last night, the president in his speech said everything will be transparent, but the Fed, in its usual manner of operating, makes everything secret.
Congress does have the authority to alter how the Fed operates. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner outlined the Obama administration's effort to kickstart the hindered credit market today so that banks begin lending to businesses and consumers again. The $1 trillion plan would establish collaboration between the private and public sectors and responds to a call to detail how the Troubled Assets Relief Program, or TARP, funds are being used. Geithner warned the recession will grow longer and deeper unless credit is restored. And although some $50 billion will be designated for homeowners to avoid foreclosure, details for that part of the plan won't be announced for another 2 weeks. Nomi Prinz is a senior fellow at Demos, a former Goldman Sachs managing director, and the author of Other People's Money. She says that despite increased transparency, there's little difference between this plan and the Bush plan.
It's not tremendously different from the Bush plan in that it fails to recognize that without a true evaluation of these toxic assets and therefore the risk that is continuing to be present in the financial system and the economic system, there can really be no effective plan. And the lack of recognition that there needs to be not just mere transparency, but a full disclosure and 100% evaluation of these assets should be intrinsic to any plan, and it doesn't seem to be intrinsic to either. Where there is some difference is in the recognition that there has to be a percentage of government funds going to subsidize home loans at the bottom of this pyramid of assets and of risk that has perpetrated the entire financial system and infiltrated into the economy. And in that respect, there is a difference in that there is also substantial focus on that. There are promises that there will be more transparency on the part of banks and their balance sheets in what Geithner said, but it's not clear from what he said how that will actually occur, given the fact that there has been no transparency to date, and that is why the markets and the economy continue to be dragged down.
Geithner talked about a public-private collaboration. Can you explain what this would mean?
Well, I think he's trying to convince the public or the American people who he recognizes and we all know are rightly skeptical of the idea of money being given into the banking system without a clear knowledge of whether that will work and how that's going to be done. And in the face of executive compensations and other things that have been funneled out on the back of that money, which Geithner did mention. And so the idea that a public funding of a fix to the banking system would come from the government and come from, therefore, the taxpayers and the public, and that at some point there would be this idea of a switchover into private investment in any of these firms at the point at which there are more private investors to decide to invest in them. So, for example, if there is a capital injection into a company like JP Morgan Chase, the idea would be that at a time when public funds are no longer necessary, there would be a transition into more private investment into the institution, which would effectively take over the capital investment that the public and the government has put into it. Geithner didn't really say how that would work in practice, and part of the problem is that private investment and private leverage in the system has been one of the causes of the current economic crisis that we're facing. And so I believe that, you know, we would need, in order for that to work, again, a not just stated, but an actual transparency of what it is inside these institutions and on their books that the public is investing in and that would transition into private investorship at some point. Otherwise, there's no reason to assume that point is coming anytime soon.
Nomi Prinz is a senior fellow at Demos, a former Goldman Sachs managing director, and the author of Other People's Money. The Senate approved the economic stimulus bill today by a vote of 61 to 37. Three Republicans, Senators Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins of Maine and Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, crossed party lines to vote in favor of the $838 billion piece of legislation. The bill designates $370 billion to tax cuts, including a $70 billion cut to the alternative minimum tax, $35 billion in tax breaks for homeowners, and $11 billion to deduct loan interest on new cars. A few spending provisions were dropped from the bill, including $40 billion for states to offset budget deficits, $20 billion for school construction and repair, and a decrease in $4 billion for food stamps. The bill now heads to a conference committee where Senate and House leaders will work out differences. President Obama would like to sign the bill before Monday, President's Day. The state of Georgia faces a $2.3 billion budget deficit and joins the list of states appealing for federal relief. While Georgia wants a piece of the federal stimulus package, citizens, advocates, and activists across the state will gather together Wednesday and Thursday with different demands. Grassroots organizations and their constituents will be calling on Georgia to implement what they call a people's bailout. FSRN's Sacagawea Hall speaks with event organizers.
This week, hundreds of people from across Georgia will gather in Atlanta for the 29th annual Poor People's Day, hosted by Georgia Citizens Coalition on Hunger, the Up and Out of Poverty Now Coalition, and the Atlanta Task Force for the Homeless. Poor People's Day combines a day of education with a day of action and legislative advocacy. In response to the current economic crisis, this year the focus is on the economic climate and calls for a people's bailout. Sandra Robertson, Executive Director of Georgia Citizen Coalition on Hunger, describes the reason for the theme.
It's been a transfer of money from the poor to the rich. It's been very clear. And the impact that that's having on human beings, on families, is devastating. And so we're in trouble. And we plan to make that clear and to make our demands known so that people can get relief, so that the people can get a bailout, because everyone's been getting a bailout on the upper end of the echelon, and no one's been getting a bailout on the lower end of the economic echelon.
The goal of Poor People's Day is to engage poor and low-income working people who often do not have a voice in the political process. By coming together to talk about the issues that impact their daily lives and discussing solutions, they aim to work towards legislation and policy changes that will address their needs. The Up and Out of Poverty Coalition, made up of about 50 organizations, started meeting in September of 2008 to outline issues they felt were most important to address in this year's Poor People's Day. Fernando Jackson of Project South Institute for the Elimination of Poverty and Genocide was a part of the process.
And we have this concept called Dotmocracy, where we list all the various issues that we want to address for this upcoming Poor People's Day, but then we also like lined out like real concrete solutions that have like house bills attached to them to really like address that issue, you know, maybe hopefully make that change happen, you know, like the living, like the minimum wage bill. You know, there's an actual bill on the table for the state of Georgia to increase it from its current $5.15 an hour up to at least $7.25, which would have it coincide with the federal standard in July.
Increasing the minimum wage is one of seven key issues included in the People's Bailout Plan. Minimum wage is also one of the effort's past success stories. In 1999, they worked to increase the minimum wage from $3.25 an hour to the $5.15 it is now. Sandra Robertson says she hears little about poor people in the national economic conversation. She believes a special emphasis on the bottom third of the economic population and investing in social programs will have a more immediate impact on the economy.
The welfare system, it needs to be totally revamped. It needs to be funded at a much higher level of funding than it's currently being funded. They need to remove the time limits, because there's no time limit on poverty and there's no time limit on unemployment. And they need to do some real training for workers at that level to move them into the 21st century. That's where money could really be a shot in the arm to the economy.
Other state issues the organizers of Poor People's Day feel are pressing include healthcare legislation, housing and homelessness, jobs and unemployment, privatization of prisons and public utilities. These will all be the topics of their Education Day, featuring workshops and plenary sessions. Some see the people's bailout as an ongoing tool in organizing the people of Georgia to make the change they want to see. Again, Fernando Jackson.
Because one thing that happened with the Obama election was that people got excited about change, but they didn't know what type of change was going to happen. They didn't know what it was going to be. I think it's time for the people to decide for themselves the world that we want to see. So what I envision is, once we unveil this people's bailout on Thursday, is to take this bailout community by community, neighborhood by neighborhood, and church group, organizations, you name it, and present it to them as like, this is just a start.
The two-day event will culminate with the unveiling of a people's bailout plan and meetings with state lawmakers. Although Sandra Robertson knows the process will not be easy, she is confident that they can win with a concentrated, organized effort. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sacagawea Hall.
The newly formed union, made up of former members of the SEIU, United Healthcare Workers West, has filed petitions for elections in 62 hospitals and healthcare facilities with the National Labor Relations Board offices in Oakland and San Francisco. The members are calling it the largest healthcare filing in California history. Max Pringle reports.
Ousted United Healthcare Workers West leaders and members formed the National Union of Healthcare Workers last week, after the SEIU put the local under trusteeship for not abiding by recommendations from former Labor Secretary Ray Marshall, who ruled that UHW leaders misused funds and ignored union rules. Former UHW members disputed the findings and formed the NUHW. Jane Silva is a psychiatric technician at Alta Bates Summit Medical Center.
We aim to restore member democracy and effective representation for healthcare workers who are now under the trusteeship of SEIU-supported trustee. In only 5 days, we have filed petitions to represent nearly 9,000 workers.
Members of the new union say they plan to submit petitions to the NLRB for thousands more workers in the coming days. Service Employees International Union representatives called the filings counterproductive and damaging to the membership of UHW. Dave Reagan is one of two trustees for United Healthcare Workers West.
It is a shameless and cynical attempt by a group of discredited and dishonorable people to put the interests of UHW members well behind their own personal interests.
SEIU President Andy Stern and other union officials said they've been making thousands of calls trying to reach out to the 150,000 members of UHW to explain the situation and tell them they plan to continue representing them in current and future negotiations. But former UHW President Sal Rosselli said the new NUHW enjoys the support of most UHW members.
Eventually, depending on the anti-union campaign that Andy Stern launches against these workers and employer relationships, the entire SEIU, United Healthcare Workers West, will be a part of the National Union of Healthcare Workers.
The underlying cause of the split between the leaderships of the SEIU and the UHW was the locals' disagreement with the SEIU's plan to transfer long-term care workers out of the UHW and into a different local. President Andy Stern said because the state pays those workers, they could better organize and lobby Sacramento as a united whole. Nelson Lichtenstein is director for the study of work, labor, and democracy at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He said the reason for the trusteeship comes down to a dispute over how the union is run.
It's kind of a question of, you know, internal democracy within the SEIU. That is, if you have a convention which votes one way, all the locals are, it's incumbent upon them to follow along. The minority accedes to the majority.
For their part, SEIU officials said the people that really lose with the union infighting are the members, as energy and resources used for the battle are taken away from organizing new members and bargaining good contracts. Dave Reagan of the SEIU said forming a new union is exactly the wrong thing to do.
If their advice is followed, there will be many, many of our members in UHW who could frankly face the evaporation of their contract and everything they've been successful in accomplishing over the years.
Both sides said they're eager to move on and to begin working on issues dear to organized labor, like the Employee Free Choice Act at the federal level and fighting layoffs and cutbacks at the state and local levels. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle.
In his first primetime press conference last night, President Obama repeated his willingness to hold diplomatic talks with Iran. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad responded Tuesday with a televised address to thousands of marchers in Tehran, marking the 30th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Ahmadinejad says Iran is ready to hold talks based on mutual respect and in a fair atmosphere. The potential for dialogue is a sharp turn from the Bush administration, which labeled Iran part of the so-called Axis of Evil. FSRN Saida Jamshidi has more on the changing tone in U.S.-Iranian relations.
Mehrdad Mashayekhi is a professor at Georgetown University and co-author of Iran Political Culture in the Islamic Republic. He believes that Iranian government is looking forward to a new start.
So in a way, Bush's policy for Iran was a failure, in the sense that he could not really do anything, first of all, consistently. There were a lot of ups and downs, a lot of zigzags, and it didn't get anywhere. So the other side also realized this, and as soon as the Bush administration's fortune started to decline, the other side, meaning the Iranian counterpart, they declined to really get involved, hoping that, you know, the administration eventually will lose the elections and it's going to be another start.
Direct diplomacy with Iranian officials could be a big step in changing the U.S. relationship with Iran. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Susan Rice has expressed the U.S. government deep concern about Iran's nuclear activities, but she also discussed the new administration's willingness to engage with Iran, including through, quote, vigorous diplomacy and direct diplomacy. Ross Carnahan is a Democratic Congress member from Missouri and a member of Middle East and South Asian Subcommittee. He is the proponent of using smart power, a term being used often by the Obama administration.
Smart power is really using all of the tools in our toolbox for making progress around the world. The Bush administration, most believe, relied too heavily on military power and not enough on diplomatic and political and economic power. I believe we miss out on opportunities when the use of U.S. power is so slanted in that way. We have opportunities to re-engage with the world, to rebuild a damaged image that has come from that. And I believe that President Obama and his administration will be very active in the use of smart power in that way.
In 5 months, Iran is electing its new president. Obama didn't want to wait until then to open the channel of smart power diplomacy. The administration wants to reach out to the key players in the Iranian establishment, including Ayatollah Khamenei, the solemn authority on Iran's foreign policy. Iran's nuclear program and its resistance to recognizing Israel in the Middle East continue to raise many eyebrows in D.C. political circles. On the international level, the European-led coalition at the UN has offered financial and political incentives to Iranians if Tehran stops enriching uranium, a route to produce fuel for nuclear weapons. But Iran rejected these activities or any precondition concessions. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Saida Jamshidi.
And that wraps up today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katabchi. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.